Was it a defensive tower to protect the community? Was it for ceremonial purposes? Was it a lookout platform to protect the spring? Perhaps the wall was needed to defend stores of grain from raiding neighbors, though some scholars think it was protection against flooding. No matter why these structures were built, they must have taken considerable planning and effort, and a lot of manpower. People must have felt that the buildings were important. Stable and somewhat larger communities like this one developed new technologies, and surprisingly extensive contacts between communities spread the new technologies widely. So when something new was invented, a new style of stone tool, for example, we can see that the ideas spread by the fact that examples of these same types of tools are found in archaeological sites distributed over hundreds of square miles. Sometimes, when I'm hiking in the countryside near my home, I think about those ancient people whose only way to contact one another over long distances was to head out and walk there. Imagine the hardships they faced, all the bad weather, difficult terrain, and predatory animals. Lions were native to the Near East long after this, even when cities were founded. Traveling would have been difficult and dangerous. So if a type of object is found spread out over a wide area in the Neolithic period, does that mean that people took these objects with them when they walked to some very distant place, maybe hundreds of miles away? A good example is obsidian. Obsidian is a form of naturally occurring glass, and it's the best possible stone for tools. It has a razor-sharp edge when you break it. Until quite recently, obsidian blades were used in surgery. Obsidian could also be polished to make mirrors. So it was something that lots of people must have wanted, and it's one of the earliest goods to have been traded over long distances. Obsidian from Anatolia, which is now Turkey, has been found at Neolithic sites right across the Near East, and even in the lands around the Aegean Sea. It was obviously very highly valued. Other things were transported far away from their places of origin as well. Seashells are found hundreds of miles from the sea, and marble bracelets were popular in many places. Bitumen from Mesopotamia was also traded across hundreds of miles. Bitumen is a sticky tar substance, like asphalt, that could be used for waterproofing boats and baskets. It's related to oil. And of course, there's a lot of oil in the Near East. But in ancient times, the only use they had for bitumen was for waterproofing. Some scholars think this amazing evidence of ancient trade doesn't mean that people were actually traveling over long distances. Perhaps dozens of middlemen were involved, each exchanging the obsidian or some other material for something valuable. And the person they traded with then traded it with someone else. Perhaps none of them had any idea of how far the goods had traveled from their places of origin in order to reach them. This seems like a reasonable assumption, that no single person traveled very far, even though the traded goods themselves did. And yet, this assumption might not have been true. The spread of farming gives us some evidence about this. Did people hear about farming and begin to try it? Did they trade the things they needed in order to farm, the sheep, goats, cattle, barley and wheat, one village at a time, spreading the ideas and the domesticates slowly? Or did farmers move from their homeland in the Near East to places hundreds or thousands of miles away, bringing the technology and domesticates with them? That last idea seemed far-fetched until recently. But DNA studies have shown that 80% of Europeans are descended from ancient Near Eastern farmers. The Europeans are also, of course, descended from indigenous populations who inhabited Europe before farming, and from any number of other groups who migrated into Europe at other times. Any one person could have millions of ancestors. The number varies depending on how much the same families continue to intermarry over time. But the fact that for 80% of Europeans, their DNA includes the DNA of ancient Near Eastern peoples means that farmers traveled in the Neolithic period and settled in new places, bringing their sheep, goats, wheat, and barley with them. The DNA of European cattle shows that they too had a Near Eastern origin. We also know, again from DNA, that millet, which is a grain or cereal crop, spread from as far away as China, coming to Eastern Europe at around the same time. A lot of people were moving around, bringing new technologies, new domesticates, and new ideas with them. So Neolithic people were more mobile than you might have expected. Some of the other technologies that began to develop in the Near East made new use of an old friend of humankind, fire. Hundreds of thousands of years before this, even before modern humans evolved, people's lives had been improved a lot by controlling fire. They used it for protection and warmth and for cooking. But in the Neolithic era, they also started using it to change natural materials like stone and clay into other forms. The first of these was plaster. To make lime plaster, you have to burn limestone, which becomes a powder. Then you add water, spreading or molding the plaster into a desired shape and letting it dry. The drying process can take a long time, but at the end, the plaster becomes hard and stone-like and resistant to water. The ancient pre-pottery Neolithic people in the Levant discovered this, and they used lime plaster to coat floors and walls. Imagine the improvement over a mud floor. The plaster could be washed and swept and covered with rugs for warmth. Plaster had other uses as well. It could be formed into sculptures, like the human figures found at the site of Ain Ghazal in Jordan. These are half life-size, with painted clothing and hair, and cowrie shells inlaid for the eyes. The Neolithic people in the Near East also used plaster to commemorate the dead. At many sites, archaeologists have found skulls separated from skeletons, with facial features reproduced in plaster, and sometimes with cowrie shells in the eye sockets. Strangely enough, these were often found in houses, right where the people lived and worked. They might have been the skulls of family ancestors, and they can be eerily lifelike. Perhaps the ancestors were worshipped, or perhaps the people believed these dead men and women watched over their families and protected them. It might seem macabre to us, but the Neolithic farmers apparently didn't think so. They also experimented with making containers out of plaster. These are called whiteware. A whiteware vessel is like a stone bowl, but it didn't have to be laboriously carved and ground into shape. It could be molded and left to set. Once dry and solid, it could hold water and other liquids and foods. But it had a problem. It couldn't be used for cooking. Put lime plaster over fire, and the lime reverts to powder. Whiteware wasn't produced for long, and it didn't spread to other regions. It was a good invention, but another one was coming along that was even better. In fact, the invention of whiteware might have even spurred that next invention. What if you could shape a vessel out of a different kind of substance and somehow involve fire in the process and get something more useful? There were, of course, other kinds of containers in early Neolithic times. Archaeologists do find some stone bowls, but they would have taken a long time to make, carving and grinding the stone into shape. And people must have had leather bags, baskets, and nets. The Neolithic people were familiar with clay and mud. They used it to make bricks, which, after being left out in the sun to dry, were hard enough to build a wall with. So, after plaster, the next great fire-related invention was pottery. This was truly revolutionary. Think of all the things you can do with pots. You can drink from them, eat from them, store things in them, including liquids, make them in a vast variety of sizes and shapes, from tiny to coffin-sized, and they did bury people in them. And, of course, you can cook in them. Pots are just fine over a flame. They don't break or decompose. Whole new culinary possibilities now opened up to the ancient villagers. People could now make porridge from grain, cooking it over the heat in a pot. And they could make soups and stews. Meat was not just roasted anymore. They also used clay to build beehive-shaped ovens, and they baked flat bread inside. These ovens, which are called tanurs, are found in ancient villages and are still used across the Middle East. Initially, in the first half of the 7th millennium BCE, pottery was fairly coarse, including some large storage vessels and small bowls. But quite quickly, the technology improved, and the ceramics became what we might consider works of art. people painted patterns on their pots with glazes so that the patterns were fired right onto the surface. Some designs show stick figures of people and animals, but mostly they were decorated with detailed and meticulous geometric patterns. Pots weren't just useful for the ancient people. They're also really useful for modern archaeologists. Mostly, a broken pot is just trash. But that trash lasts pretty much forever. Unlike organic materials like baskets and bags, potsherds don't decompose. And, unlike metal objects, which were invented later, they don't corrode, and they can't be melted down and reused. A potsherd found in the ground today looks almost exactly the same as when it was thrown away thousands of years ago. So when archaeologists find broken pieces of pottery all over the ground in places where ancient people lived, they can use these potsherds to figure out when a site was occupied. Pottery went through phases, like fashions. Sometimes the fabric of the pot was yellow, sometimes reddish or brown. Sometimes the glazes were shiny, sometimes matte. The shapes changed, as did the thickness of the ceramic walls. A fragment of pottery is as dateable as a car design. You wouldn't mistake a 1948 Ford for a 1992 Toyota. Archaeologists have that same eye for pots. They can tell Neolithic pots from later ones and can identify more or less when they were made. So when they find pottery fragments dating to a particular era, they know the site was occupied at that time. Most Neolithic settlements were still small villages, but the villagers began to experiment with new construction techniques. In the 8000s BCE, even before pottery was invented, people had begun to use bricks for construction and built their houses in rectangular shapes. We're so used to rectangular rooms that they don't seem exceptional at all. But initially, they were revolutionary. Square corners allowed more houses to be built next to one another. An extreme case of this is seen in the city of Çatalhöyük in Turkey. Çatalhöyük is a remarkable place, a veritable town of maybe hundreds of inhabitants that thrived around 6000 BCE. That was a time when most other communities were just the size of villages. Çatal had regular rectangular buildings all jammed up against one another without doors and without streets in between. So you had to enter your house by a ladder from the roof. The ladder was almost always on the south side of the building, for some reason, with the hearth and the oven under the entry hole in the ceiling. This lack of doors and streets might have been good for the town's protection, whether from other people, animals, or the elements. It gets very cold on the Anatolian Plateau in the winter and very hot in the summer, so all those adjacent walls would have served as insulation against the weather extremes. But this also meant that people had to learn how to live peacefully with one another in very close quarters. The walls and floors of the houses in Çatalhöyük were almost all plastered with lime plaster. So were the brick benches that lined some of the walls and the raised platforms that were found in every house. And some of the walls were brightly painted. Some of the rooms in Çatalhöyük had plaster sculptures on the walls, in the shapes of the heads of cattle and female figures. The first excavations at Çatalhöyük were directed by James Mellart. Mellart called these rooms shrines, and he thought they had a religious purpose. Professor Ian Hodder, who has worked to excavate Çatal, believes that these pictures and sculpted figures represent a crucial development. People had to overcome their fears of wild animals and death before they could truly domesticate the natural world. By creating artworks that showed things that they feared, and even having them inside their homes, they were able to start to control their environments. Now, remember that these people were just like modern humans in terms of their mental and physical abilities. They didn't have a way to write down their ideas, so we don't know what they were thinking. But we can be sure that they talked and planned, and that some people came up with exciting new ideas. We can also be sure that they mourned their dead. There were about 480 burials in the small area of Çatalhöyük that has been excavated. Almost all of them are under the platforms in the houses. It looks as though some of the bodies were excarnated before burial. The flesh had been removed. This might have been taken care of by vultures, as shown in the wall paintings. A family's ancestors were safely buried right beneath the floors where their descendants lived and slept. Like earlier people in the Levant, they plastered some of the skulls and painted them red. The people clearly had religious ideas that might have had something to do with the plaster models of bulls and females. And they probably had a belief in an afterlife and a sense that dead ancestors had some sort of continuing power in the world of the living. But it's impossible to figure out the details. Çatalhöyük had been occupied for centuries before the time of the town that Mellart and Hodder excavated. There are lots of occupation levels below the excavated ones, from time periods before the Neolithic. The people who first settled there probably chose the site because it was close to a river and also near a volcano where they could pick up obsidian. The people of Çatalhöyük might have been on one end of a trading network, benefiting from the fact that they were able to trade obsidian with other regions. Imported seashells were also found at the site. Even at this early time, when no one seems to have been richer than anyone else, people already seem to have had a desire for beautiful things that weren't available near home. Most of Mesopotamia, that's modern Iraq, was pretty much uninhabited at this time. It's just too hot and dry. Other than at Jericho, which is near the Jordan River, and at a few other isolated places, people could farm only if there was enough rainfall to water their crops. They hadn't yet started digging canals from the local rivers to water their fields that way. Some recent excavations, though, show there were a number of early Neolithic farming settlements in the far south around the Persian Gulf. One theory is that what is now the Persian Gulf wasn't filled with water until about 14,000 years ago. It was a deep valley, and ancient hunters and gatherers lived there in the so-called Gulf Oasis. Then, between 14,000 and 8,000 years ago, sea levels rose and swamped more than 100,000 square kilometers of land with seawater. Even after this inundation, there was still much more dry land around the Gulf than today, and Neolithic villages prospered. The cattle that they herded had local origins, but their sheep had come from further north. Interestingly, this might be where cats were first domesticated. Some scholars think cats domesticated themselves in a way. They were drawn to the rodents that would have populated human settlements, and they began to live comfortably among humans, even though the people who resided there didn't necessarily do anything to encourage them. And cats' personalities haven't changed. They still don't seem to need us all that much. They just grace us with their presence. Around 6000 BCE, farmers began to move south from the foothills into the floodplain of Mesopotamia as they figured out how to dig irrigation canals to water their crops. The Mesopotamian plain is very flat. It consists of thousands of years of silt laid down by the floods of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. This silty soil is rich and fertile when watered, so the irrigated fields would have produced plenty of food. The situation in ancient Egypt was similar, but with some important differences. In Egypt, the annual flood arrived right before the sowing season. As soon as the waters receded, farmers planted their seeds, and the ground was wet enough to need minimal additional irrigation. The land produced abundant crops with little need for human intervention beyond sowing, tending, and harvesting. Mesopotamian farmers had a much more difficult situation as they tried to use the river water to irrigate their fields. One difference from Egypt is the Mesopotamian rivers were, in places, higher than the land. This was an advantage in a way. If you breached the natural levee on either side, some of the river water flowed downhill into your fields. It didn't need to be lifted into irrigation canals with buckets. You just needed to be sure to have a way of controlling or stopping the flow when necessary. But when the annual floods came and river water spilled over the banks, there was no guarantee the river would end up flowing along the same course as before. If your village was near the banks of a river, which almost all of them were, so the villagers could use the water for irrigation, you could be out of luck if the river rerouted itself after the flooding receded. Another problem for farmers in Mesopotamia was the flood came at the wrong time of year. Seeds needed to be sowed in the spring, but the flood came in early summer. The floodwaters would have washed away the young plants. So from the start, Mesopotamians who moved into the river valleys needed to find ways to control the rivers, making sure they didn't change course and they didn't flood the fields at the wrong times. This meant the villagers needed to join forces to do some pretty big construction projects, such as reinforcing and raising levees on both banks of the river and protecting fields with dikes and reservoirs. These efforts became a constant feature of Mesopotamian life and meant that communities always had to work together. It was too much labor for one family or even a group of families to manage alone. Some of the earliest communities to spread into central Mesopotamia from the north belonged to the Samarran culture, which is named after the site of Samarra where their pottery was first identified. Samarran pottery is very distinctive, with a matte finish, and it's often decorated with drawings of animals and humans in black paint. Sometimes even the necks were shaped with three-dimensional human faces and eyes shaped like coffee beans stuck on as appliques. These types of pots are found all across central and northern Mesopotamia. They seem to have been valuable trade items. They were even sometimes repaired with bitumen, that sticky tar substance, when the pots broke. The repaired item would not have been very sturdy or useful for cooking, but it must have been treasured by the people who owned it. The Samarran people also used clay to make figurines, often with those same coffee bean eyes as on some of the pots. Most were of women, who were depicted with necklaces and designs on their bodies that might have represented tattoos. The site of Tel es-Sawan is probably the best known Samarran site. It's in an area that sometimes had enough rainfall for agriculture, but the weather was unreliable. Early farmers were able to use the annual flooding of local streams to supplement the rainfall. Later, they seem to have dug irrigation canals and begun the long Mesopotamian struggle to bring their rivers and streams under control. The buildings at Tel es-Sawan are surprisingly large and T-shaped. And the exterior walls had some niches and buttresses, which later became characteristic of Mesopotamian architecture. Almost all of these houses were the same size and shape, probably with one dwelling per family. There's no sign that anyone was particularly rich or poor. The population seems to have been fairly equal. But they must have had some sort of village-level organization in order to plan their irrigation activities. The people there grew several kinds of wheat as well as barley. Bones found at the site show they herded sheep and goats, which no doubt provided wool and milk. And they owned cattle. They also still hunted wild gazelle, deer, and boar, and they fished as well. A culture that flourished after the Samarran and to the north of it is known as the Halaf. The Halaf culture flourished across northern Mesopotamia and even into Syria and southern Anatolia from around 5700 to 5000 BCE. This whole region has enough rainfall for agriculture, so they didn't need to irrigate their fields. The Halaf people built both round and rectangular houses and mostly lived in small villages where they farmed the same crops and herded the same animals that we've come across everywhere. The thing that stands out most is that the Halaf people made incredibly beautiful ceramics. The pots were handcrafted in elegant shapes with detailed and meticulous designs, and they seem to have been traded far and wide. Or perhaps they were made by potters who moved from town to town. Halaf pots reflect such a high level of craftsmanship that archaeologists believe they must have been made by specialists, people who made pots for a living, rather than your typical farmer. These men, or perhaps women, would have depended on exchanging the pots they made for food. So, by 5000 BCE, the farmers of the Neolithic period had spread right across the Near East, even into areas where they couldn't depend on rainfall to water their crops, and where they needed to irrigate their fields. They also traded with one another over very long distances for valuable goods like seashells for jewelry, bitumen for waterproofing, obsidian for stone tools, and even handmade goods like beautiful pots. A few of the villages grew to the size of towns, such as Jericho and Çatalhöyük, with hundreds of residents. But most communities were still relatively small. And although some people must have specialized in particular crafts, There don't seem to have been any distinctions between rich and poor people yet. But that was about to change.
Lecture 4, Eridu and Other Towns in the Ubaid Period.
The Mesopotamian people of the Halaf culture lived mostly in small villages in the 6th millennium BCE. They farmed and used simple irrigation canals to water their fields. They herded sheep and goats. They prized exotic goods from far away, things like obsidian and seashells, and used exquisite pottery and fine stone tools made by highly skilled craftsmen. These people probably told stories about the past and about their heroes and gods. But they wrote nothing down, because no one had conceived of writing yet. The only way we know anything about them is from the buildings they abandoned and the objects they left lying around. Objects that eventually were covered up by dirt and debris, and that archaeologists could uncover later. By 6000 BCE, some big changes were taking place elsewhere in Mesopotamia, and these continued for the next 2000 years. This is what archaeologists call the Ubaid culture, named for the site where the culture was first identified, in the far south of Mesopotamia. Until the last decades of the 20th century, the Ubaid culture was almost always discussed as a southern Mesopotamian phenomenon. That idea has started to change. But let's begin where the scholars started to understand this period, just to the north of the Persian Gulf, in what is now southern Iraq. One village there was later known as Eridu, and this might already have been its name in 6000 BCE. There's been a community at the site since as early as 8000 BCE. When people first settled around Eridu, it was a swampy area where the fresh water from the Tigris and Euphrates rivers spread out into marshes, not far from the saltier waters of the Gulf. Until about 12000 BCE, the area was a wide valley. It flooded gradually. The process took about 6000 years. And by 6000 BCE, the Gulf was at its highest point, stretching considerably further north than today. It used to be thought that towns in this region started to grow because people discovered how to dig and manage large irrigation canals. The logic held that with these canals, fields became more productive, which fed larger populations, requiring a larger workforce to build bigger canals, which in turn brought more fields into cultivation and allowed for even larger populations, and so on. But a number of researchers have turned this theory on its head. They think that extensive farming was made possible by the water already in the swampy soil, and that this gave rise to larger communities than had been possible anywhere else. In this view, only when the wetlands began to dry out did the people have to find some other way to keep their fields productive, so as to feed the large numbers of people who were already living in the new towns. At that point, communities would have turned to irrigation. The creation of the canals must have taken a lot of thought and effort. Canals had to be cleaned to keep them free from silt. They had to be higher than the surrounding fields, so that gravity would feed the water into smaller canals out in the fields. The people needed ways to effectively keep the water in check when it wasn't needed, and ways to prevent it from gushing out too fast and destroying crops when it was needed. They had to dig reservoirs and build levees. No doubt the people of Eridu and other southern towns made plenty of mistakes along the way, but eventually they figured it out. There must have been some people in charge who called up workers to help with the construction and maintenance of the canals. And there must have been a way to compensate those workers for their time. This type of organization wasn't new for humans. Thousands of years earlier, at Göbekli Tepe, in modern-day Turkey, hundreds of Neolithic workers joined forces to build a stone temple. At Eridu, though, the workers lived in a local community year-round, and the farms around the settlement supported bigger families. It's pretty amazing that they were able to create this type of organization without a writing system. So, Eridu must have been an attractive place to live. It had plenty of fields and food. And there was another benefit to living in Eridu, too. It was home to a major god. Perhaps people felt safer, knowing that this god was right there in the community with them. At the beginning of the Ubaid period, when Eridu was still a small community, the shrine to this god was modest, just a square brick room with an altar at the end and an offering stand in the middle. Over time, as the town got bigger, the temple was rebuilt on an ever grander and more impressive scale, but always on exactly the same sacred spot. Fish bones on the altar suggest that right from earliest times, the shrine was dedicated to the god of sweet water. It's likely this was true because for thousands of years, Eridu continued to be the home of this god, whose name was Enki. Monumental architecture, such as this temple, was one of the remarkable features of the growing towns of the Ubaid period. Eridu wasn't the only town with a large temple in its center, and these temples had certain features that continued down through many subsequent centuries of Mesopotamian history. One feature was that the temples continued to be rebuilt in the same place over and over again. As a result, the older walls and floors came to be encased in a platform under the latest version of the temple. Another feature was that the temples were built on what we call a tripartite plan, which included a courtyard with an altar where offerings were burned. And near it, there would be a holy room that housed a statue of the god who owned the temple. Maybe the most striking feature of these early temples to an ancient viewer would have been their exterior walls. They were decorated with brick buttresses, which created shadows in the sunshine and gave the structures the appearance of having vertical stripes. Archaeologists often refer to this as a niche and buttress facade. It was a hallmark of Mesopotamian temple architecture. The buildings were not designed haphazardly. We know this because an analysis of the ground plans of the temples shows that the Ubaid period had a standard measurement. It's been called an Ubaid cubit that measured 72 centimeters or about 28 inches. The designer of a building laid out the exterior wall in these 72 centimeter increments, just as we use inches and feet or centimeters and meters. Remember that they had no writing yet, but they were already thinking of the abstract geometry of a structure before it was built. Let's go back to the temple honoring the god Enki. You can imagine how important Enki was to the people living in the southern part of Mesopotamia. The water that he provided came up from the ground and flowed in the rivers. This water was precious to them. They needed it for their crops and for drinking and bathing. Everything about it was good. It's not surprising that Enki was the one god who always watched out for humans. Even when other gods were causing all kinds of problems, Enki would have human interests at heart. Or at least that's what the later Mesopotamians believed. We can't be sure about religion during the Ubaid period, but there was no major break between the Ubaid people and the people who would later develop writing, so they probably had similar beliefs. Anyway, there was Eridu, home to the beloved god Enki and his ever more beautiful temple, surrounded by lush fields that must have seemed like a miracle in the dry south. And the community had a thriving, growing population. The men who lived there would have been called up, not just to keep expanding the canal system, but also to build each new iteration of the temple. No doubt the area became a magnet to merchants and traveling craftsmen who brought goods from distant places. That's because it was home to a captive audience of buyers for their goods. And this would make it even more attractive as a place to live. So it began to look less like a village and more like what we would recognize as a town, though still with only perhaps 3,000 inhabitants. Houses in Ubaid period communities like Eridu began to vary in size. Some were bigger than others. Some graves were richer than others as well. And even babies were sometimes buried with luxury gifts. A rich burial for a baby suggests that its family might have been wealthy, wealthier perhaps than others. These are early hints of social stratification. Some people were clearly richer than others. Any number of causes could have been behind this. Some fields produced abundant crops because they were closer to the canals. If you owned one of these fields, you might have been better off than someone with a more distant field. Some craftsmen made better textiles or better pots or better beads, and perhaps were able to bargain for more goods in exchange. Some people began to wield more power, perhaps because they were serving as foremen on the construction projects or as priests or priestesses of the gods. Perhaps the religious leaders had access to the food gifts that were dedicated to the gods. This was presumably after the gods had taken their portions. Though, since they were statues, they wouldn't have been able to eat the food given to them in the usual way. The gods somehow absorbed the essence of the food. Its smell, perhaps. And the priests shared what was left. To our eyes, that would be the whole offering. But they believed that the gods really got their food first this way. More technological advances accompanied the growth of towns. One was in the use of copper. Almost all the copper that we use today has been smelted from ore, which are rocks that look nothing like copper. My daughter did a science fair project in sixth grade to try to smelt copper. With her dad's help, she took a nondescript stone, malachite, and heated it to a very high temperature in a little kiln that they put together in the barbecue, using an air gun to make the coals as hot as possible. And at the end, she produced just a few specks of bright metal. Honestly, it's just so unlikely. You could see why ancient people would have taken a long time to discover this. Why would a rock produce a metal? Why would you think to try to burn it up to find out? But some copper, like some gold, is found in a metallic form in nature, and you don't have to smelt it. Just imagine how magical this substance must have seemed if you found it lying there. Almost nothing else in nature shines like copper or gold. And when you take a hammer to this lump of native copper, it doesn't fracture into tiny pieces the way the rock does. It bends. You can make it into shapes like beads or pendants. Of course, copper isn't found in southern Mesopotamia. It had to come from a great distance, from what is now Turkey in the north or from Oman in the south. But it was imported this early, and it's found in Ubaid period sites like Eridu, and it was used as jewelry. The metal workers seem to have discovered that native copper became brittle the more you pounded it, and that it became more flexible again when heated in the fire. This is called annealing. It's a long way from smelting copper out of ore, but perhaps it got them thinking about how fire might transform other materials, just as it transformed limestone into lime to make plaster, and as it transformed soft, pliable clay into hard pottery. The Ubaid people used clay for a lot of things, not just pottery and bricks. They formed clay into crescent shapes, baked it hard to give it a sharp edge, and used the resulting object as a clay sickle for cutting grain. They also formed clay into balls, baked them hard, kept these balls in piles, and used them in slingshots as weapons. We don't know whether they had any sort of organized military force yet, but slingshots would have been useful if your town was attacked. And speaking of clay, the pottery in the Ubaid period was quite distinctive. This is helpful to scholars because it allows us to know if a site was occupied or how to date a level within a site. You see a layer of Ubaid sherds, or pottery fragments, and you know. The pots weren't as fine or delicate as earlier Halaf ceramics had been, but they are attractive. Shallow bowls were popular. They were pale with a dark band around the rim. Ubaid pots of all shapes often had dark geometric patterns. Also, for the first time, potters began to mark their pots with special designs that might be potter's marks, almost like a signature that a potter could use to claim that a pot was his or her own work. And here's a remarkable thing. Ubaid-style pottery is found all over the Near East, from Turkey in the west to Iran in the east, and as far south as southeastern Arabia, in what is now the United Arab Emirates. Ubaid pots spread over thousands of miles. As with so many dramatic changes in ancient history, sometimes it's hard for us today to get excited about such things. In the modern world, you can go to Starbucks in Los Angeles or Paris or Rio de Janeiro. In the same way, you can buy exactly the same style of mug or plate pretty much anywhere in the world. And this doesn't seem especially remarkable. We take it for granted that objects and ideas are transported over vast regions. But in 4000 BCE, things were completely different. Everything from this period that appears far from its point of origin had to be carried over land or sea and passed from one person to another. It's not that the Ubaid people built an empire and brought their pots with them. Instead, a whole group of innovations seem to have spread as a result of interactions between people who were traveling further afield than before. These cultural interactions created even more complexity in the societies that were in touch with one another. Let's look at connections to the south, the region of the Persian Gulf. In Kuwait, archaeologists have found the very earliest remains of a boat, the earliest anywhere in the world. What they found was slabs of bitumen encrusted with barnacles and with impressions from reed bundles and ropes. The barnacles show that the bitumen coated something that spent a lot of time in the water, which was almost certainly a boat. And the reeds and ropes show how the boat was constructed. Boats like these were used to sail south from Mesopotamia to areas around the Persian Gulf. The Mesopotamians would have encountered other people already living there, who had their own cultures, architecture, their own ways of life. A site called Bahra in Kuwait shows a lot of influence from the Ubaid people of southern Mesopotamia. Their buildings were even similar. Some archaeologists think that perhaps people moved there from Mesopotamia. Others believe that the local people admired and imitated Mesopotamian culture, including its architecture. Another site, called Wadi Debayan, further south in what is now Qatar, has Ubaid pottery, along with some other remarkable imports, including obsidian that came all the way from the Taurus Mountains in Turkey. But it wasn't just these two places. Excavators have found Ubaid pottery at about 60 archaeological sites in the Arabian Peninsula. The pottery seems to have been a luxury, and local people in Arabia didn't just import these pots, they made local copies as well. What would have inspired someone from, say, Eridu, to invest in building a boat, load it up with Ubaid pots, and perhaps also with locally made textiles, and then head off on what was certainly a treacherous trip across the sea, journeying hundreds of miles to a foreign and potentially hostile land? Perhaps they were already interested in goods that came from this region. Later traders brought pearls, shells, copper, incense, and diorite stone from the lands around the Gulf. And this might already have been true. Some archaeologists suggest the Ubaid people purchased fish there to take back with them, but that seems unlikely, though the earliest travelers there may have been fishermen using nets to get their own fish. Archaeologists have found that the Ubaid people of southern Mesopotamia also had contact with regions hundreds of miles to the north of them. Here, though, the culture seems in some ways to have been even more sophisticated than in the southern region where the Ubaid culture was first discovered. This was not a provincial area. Let me tell you about some of the sites so you see what I mean. Tepe Garwa is near Nineveh, outside modern-day Mosul in northern Iraq. Long after this, in the 7th century BCE, Nineveh was the capital of the Assyrian Empire. Tepe Garwa was excavated in the mid-20th century, and archaeologists working there could see right away how closely it was related to the Ubaid culture. Its monumental buildings were constructed with the same design as in the south, with external niches and buttresses and a tripartite form. And we know now that the builders at Tepe Garwa even used the same standard Ubaid cubit of 72 centimeters in their design and construction. People there used the same type of pottery as well. The town at Tepe Garwa was much smaller than Eridu, but it had a cemetery that showed the same growing divisions in wealth that you find in the south. There were gold rosettes and gold studs in some of the tombs. One tomb contained an extraordinary wolf's head vessel made from electrum, which is a naturally occurring alloy of gold and silver. And there were ground stone bowls made of obsidian. All of these materials, gold, electrum, and obsidian, had to be imported from far away. Anyone who could take these types of luxury goods to the afterlife with him or her was someone with power. Three sites in Syria, far to the west of Tepe Garwa and far to the north of Eridu, have given us even more evidence for this period. One is Tel Zeidan, another is Tel Brak, and the third is Tel Hamukar. Tel Zeidan is the furthest to the west, on the east bank of the Balikh River. The other two, Brak and Hamukar, are in the region known as the Habur Triangle. This is in northern Syria, near what is now the Turkish border. A lot of small rivers flow south across the wide triangular region, joining together to form the Habur River, which flows south to the Euphrates. The Habur Triangle extends about 100 miles from west to east. It gets enough rainfall for agriculture, but the rivers provide added irrigation water when needed. So it's always been a rich, productive area. All three sites were occupied during the Ubaid period and have Ubaid-style pottery and architecture. But they weren't dependent on the south for inspiration. Tel Zeidan, for instance, has some of the earliest evidence of copper smelting. This set the stage for the enormously important development of bronze. Copper is too soft for weapons and for most tools, but once you smelt copper from ore, rather than just hammering native copper into shape, it's a much smaller step to add arsenic to the mix to make a harder metal called arsenic bronze. Later, arsenic was replaced with tin. Tin was more difficult to obtain because it came from further away, but unlike arsenic, it wasn't toxic when you smelted it. By 5000 BCE, the people of Tel Zeidan had built a big wall around their settlement. The town grew to be as large as Eridu, 30 acres. That's about the size of 5.5 city blocks in New York City. Zeidan is estimated to also have had about the same population as Eridu, 3,000 inhabitants. This sounds quite small to us today, but it was immeasurably bigger and more complex than the villages that had preceded it. Two other finds from Zeidan give us a sense of this complexity. One is the discovery of 8 large kilns for firing pottery. This was not a household-level craft. Instead, these were probably owned by a town institution, perhaps the temple, for firing very large quantities of pots. Again, we can marvel at the organization that this must have involved. Even more notable was the discovery of stamp seals and sealings. These weren't used in the south yet, but were found at Tel Zeidan, Tel Brak, and Tel Hamukar. Each seal probably was used by an important person and was stamped into lumps of clay to seal goods or doorways. A sealed doorway wasn't necessarily locked, but it couldn't be opened without breaking the seal, so people would know that someone had been in the room. A pot with a sealed stopper was safe from pilfering fingers because a broken seal wouldn't go unnoticed. Each seal was carved with a design that would have identified it as belonging to a particular person. Seals of this kind are found as early as 7000 BCE in the north, but they were unknown at this point in the south. So perhaps the towns of the north had more complex administrations and hierarchies. Luxury goods came to these northern sites through trade. The people were importing copper and obsidian from Anatolia and bitumen from Iraq. A particularly fine example of an object made from imported materials was found at Tel Brak. It came from a context that the excavators date to around 4000 BCE, towards the end of the Ubaid period. They called it a chalice because of its tall, elegant, fluted shape. It had black obsidian cup on a white marble base, with the two pieces cemented together with the sticky tar substance, bitumen. Bitumen at the top might have cemented a gold inlay into a groove, but the gold, if that's what it was missing by the time the excavators recovered the chalice. It's an example of a very high level of workmanship. In contrast, a lot of the pots and plates found at Tel Brak were crudely made. The excavators see this as clear evidence of social stratification. Tel Hamukar was smaller than Tel Zeidan and the southern towns, but it had a wall around it and monumental buildings, along with those all-important stamp seals. A few of the seals, used at both Hamukar and Brak, were decorated with images of lions. The carving of these lions is stunning. One example from Tel Brak is an impression of a seal that's barely 2 inches across, but manages to convey the power and majesty of the lion, with even the muscles in its legs and details of its muzzle represented. Curiously, it seems to have hooks on its paws like a bird. Lions could be found in the wild in Syria, and the lion was probably already seen as the king of the beasts because of its ferocity and speed. Later in Mesopotamian history, lions came to symbolize royalty, so it's tempting to imagine these as royal seals, but we should be cautious before jumping to conclusions. There's no other evidence for kings this early. Still, someone had enough power to use the lion as the symbol on his stamp seal and to employ a craftsman of extraordinary talent. It's interesting to wonder how much of our conception of southern Mesopotamia as the cradle of civilization comes from the fact that southern sites like Eridu were excavated first. If the Ubaid period towns of Syria had been found before them, we would think of the Ubaid culture as a northern development that spread to the south, perhaps, rather than the other way around. It does seem true that the idea of using seals to signify ownership or control was a northern innovation, and that copper smelting developed earlier in the north than the south. On the other hand, the next big development in the history of the region, and of the world for that matter, originated in southern Mesopotamia without a doubt. It's not that anyone invaded or introduced a new culture, but during the years from 3800 to 3000 BCE, the southern Mesopotamian people positively exploded with innovations, while their largest city, Uruk, grew to perhaps 10 times the size of the towns of the Ubaid period. This period, starting with the Ubaid period and continuing into the Uruk period, is sometimes referred to as the urban revolution. Like the agricultural revolution thousands of years before, it marks a turning point for humankind. Once people started living in cities, the idea of the city never went away. Individual cities might be abandoned, whole areas might go back to a rural way of life, but there were still cities flourishing elsewhere, and there have been ever since.
Lecture 5, Uruk, the world's biggest city.
Think about all the time that has passed since urban civilization began more than 5,500 years ago. It sounds like an eternity. Historians who specialize in the United States investigate and write about people who lived maybe 100 or 200 years ago. Colleagues in medieval studies might analyze documents from 600 or 700 years ago. 5,500 years is on a different scale altogether. Fellow historians often view my field as impossibly distant in time. But you can look at it another way. I thought about this when my son was born. His birth coincided with the death of the comedian George Burns. It's amazing to my son that his life overlapped that of someone who was born in 1896. Just 10 years after the German engineer Carl Benz patented the first gasoline-powered vehicle, and before the invention of the airplane, before houses had electricity or telephones, and before most of them had indoor bathrooms. Grover Cleveland was the president, and some veterans of the War of 1812 were still alive. And you can go back the same way to another centenarian. George Burns's life overlapped with that of a man named Colm de Baylis, who lived to the grand old age of 109. By the time he died, young George Burns was 10 years old. De Baylis was an Irish poet who was born in 1796, when George Washington was still president. And de Baylis had been 5 years old when an elderly princess, Princess Isabella of Brunant, died at the age of 104. Brunant is an island in the Mediterranean, and Princess Isabella had been born in 1697. So, the slightly overlapping lives of just three people, the comedian George Burns, the poet Colm de Baylis, and Princess Isabella of Brunant, take us back to the reign of Louis XIV. Add one more 100-year lifetime, and we're in 1596, with Shakespeare writing his early plays. And another, just five lifetimes ago, and Columbus was returning to Spain after his second voyage to the New World. You can keep this up, going back one centenarian after another. Just 55 long lives, back to back, take us to the very beginning of cities. Even if you measure in the normal way, using parent-child generations, it's only about 200 of them from this moment now, right to the dawn of civilization. As a comparison, we're separated from the earliest humans by hundreds of thousands of generations. So 200 generations since the start of civilization is not very long at all. We're babies at this business of civilization, if you look at it that way. We're living right at the beginning of history. Always supposing we humans managed not to destroy the planet or make our species extinct, We could survive as long as our pre-modern human ancestors did, millions of years. From that perspective, not only are we just getting started, but in relative terms, the Mesopotamians built their first cities pretty much yesterday. Think of all the things that we still have around us that started in ancient times. We live in rectangular houses made of natural materials like brick and wood, just as they did. Our houses are arranged on streets with front doors and with specialized rooms for socializing, sleeping, and bathing, just like theirs. We marry and have children and worry about disease, just like them. We obey laws, go to court if laws are broken. Our governments recruit armies who fight their enemies to the death in battle. We send diplomats to negotiate peace treaties. We worship gods. We bury our dead. We grow crops on farms, and we herd the same animals. We wear clothes made of animal products, wool and leather, and plant products, cotton and linen. To communicate, we use our hands to write with implements on natural materials, paper in our case, clay in the example of our predecessors. We tell stories and sing songs. In a great many ways, we still live like the Mesopotamians. This was even more true just 150 years ago, before modern medicine and electricity, cars, airplanes, computers, the internet, and so on. But even now, we are not that far removed from the kind of life that Mesopotamian people led, from about 3800 BCE to 3100 BCE, right when cities were getting started and writing was invented. We call this the Uruk period, because Uruk was the world's first great city. If we could travel back in time, we'd recognize their lives, their cares, and their environment. It's not that different from ours. There's no way to know what the future holds, but I would bet that in a few thousand years, if they're still teaching courses about the history of the world, they'll include societies from ancient Mesopotamia to at least the 19th century in the category of ancient history, and make generalizations that apply to all of us. All of this is to say that this lecture covers a crucial moment in human history, the early development of urban civilization. My students often assume that life in the first cities was much more chaotic and violent than now, but there's no evidence to suggest they're right. People seem to have adjusted to city living quite quickly and to have developed new norms of behavior. They also became more technologically innovative and more interested in the world beyond Mesopotamia. The place to start exploring this era is the city of Uruk, not far from Eridu in southern Mesopotamia. Scholars generally agree that by 3500 BCE, it was the biggest city in the world. It was surrounded by an immense brick wall that enclosed 260 hectares. That's about 642 acres, the size of a big university. That doesn't sound big for a city today, but it was huge for its time. Uruk had two major temple precincts, with a temple at the center of each and surrounding courtyards and buildings. One was dedicated to the goddess Inanna, who was the goddess of love. The other was dedicated to Anu, the god of the heavens. The number of people called on to build these temples must have been enormous. One theory suggests that the temples took about 100 years to build and were immediately rebuilt as soon as they were finished to keep the population constantly employed. The temples would have been as impressive to visitors as medieval cathedrals were in their own time. One of the temple buildings was constructed of stone, which was rare in this area. Another had an eye-dazzling mosaic of colored geometrical patterns. These were made with clay cones impressed into mortar on huge interior columns and then polished. As many as 25,000 people lived in the city of Uruk at this time. But they weren't like modern city dwellers. The whole economy was based on farming, and most of the citizens would have owned or worked on farmland around the city. This was true throughout Mesopotamian history. Most Mesopotamian city dwellers walked out to the fields in the morning, spent their days farming, and returned to the city when it got dark. The efficiency of farming improved during the Uruk period with the invention of the plow. No longer did farmers have to dig holes in the ground and poke seeds into these openings in the earth. The blade on a plow, drawn by an ox or a donkey, could turn the soil over much more effectively, and the farmer could plant the seeds as he walked behind. Canals had also improved since the Ubaid period, which had lasted from about 6,000 to 3,800 BCE. Now the Mesopotamians could build canals big enough to sail boats in. The soil in the fields was naturally fertile. It was made up of silt that had washed down the river Euphrates over the eons. With effective irrigation and the plow, the fields became even more productive. Uruk peoples also improved bronze production and invented